So this Sunday is the fast of the 17th of Tammuz, and it begins the 3 weeks leading up to Tisha B'Av. This is the most difficult period of the Jewish year. It's time we reflect upon exile and destruction and tragedy and catastrophe which we've experienced for all these years. I point out yearly, we don't always feel it. You know, it's something, you know, thank God we live very comfortable lives in modern days in America. And we don't feel that we're lacking all that much. You know, physically and spiritually, we have a lot of things we can access and enjoy. And when we're supposed to reflect upon catastrophe and tragedy and destruction, often we don't sense what we're missing. The rabbis instituted different restrictions this time of year, so we do remember, we do focus on it. If not for the restrictions, so then we totally forget about it. So we have 3 weeks of the year, we're not supposed to shave, we're not supposed to listen to music, make weddings, wear new clothing.
Wash
you can wash clothes until nine days before Tisha B'Av, right? But that's later on. But during these 3 weeks, it's a time where we do have restrictions, which are supposed to make us focus and recognize that there's something missing in our lives.
I'm sorry. How many days before Tisha B'Av?
So we have 3 weeks between this Sunday
right,
and Tisha B'Av,
right.
And then the 9 days prior to Tisha B'Av, you have more strict restrictions.
Okay.
Which we talk about, I guess. But during these 3 weeks, you have a few restrictions, very similar to the time of the Omer. Weddings, music, shaving. That's during these 3 weeks. Now, and again, the restrictions serve a purpose, because they're there to make us actually recognize this time of year, so there's something to think about. If we didn't have any restrictions, and we just went on with this as usual, we wouldn't think about anything. So the rabbis, in their wisdom, said, I'm giving you some restrictions this time of year. And these restrictions are supposed to focus you in on what's happening. This time of year is bracketed off by 2 days. You have the 17th of Tammuz, which is the fast which is occurring this Sunday. Happens to be this year, the actual date is on Shabbos, which is pushed off to Sunday because you don't fast on Shabbos. And then it ends with Tisha B'Av, which is, again, this year Tisha B'Av is on Shabbos, you push on Sunday as well. So actually this year you're going from the 18th of Tammuz to the 10th of Av, more exact. But those 2 days bracket off the period. Now those 2 days carry within them a major significance. On the 17th of Tammuz, the original, I guess, event of that day was the day where the Jews were worshiping the golden calf. That was where Moshe broke the tablets. That was they came down from Mount Sinai and he saw the Jews worshiping the golden calf. That was the beginning, that was the original 17th of Tammuz. Later on in history, the day also carried within it much tragedy. Namely, I guess the most prevalent of it, or the most significant, is there's a day where the Babylonians, the Romans, breached the walls of Jerusalem. That was 17th of Tammuz. So they had put a siege on the city, and on the 17th of Tammuz they breached the walls and they entered into the city and they destroyed the temple 3 weeks later. The 9th of Av, which ends the period, so the original 9th of Av was the day where the Jews came back. The spies came back from Israel with evil reports about the land, as we had in Parsha Shlach. And that was the day where God decreed the Jews had to remain in the desert for 40 years and wander and couldn't enter the land. That was the beginning of the tragedy of Tisha B'Av. Later in history, again, many events happened on Tisha B'Av, which we could talk about in future weeks. But the main event we focused on during this time of year was the destruction of both temples. The first and second temple were both destroyed on Tisha B'Av, the ninth day of Av. But this period is bracketed off by 2 days of terrible sin, 2 days of terrible destruction, and in between those 2 days, those 3 weeks are times that we're supposed to reflect upon the loss and figure out what are we missing. Put it into perspective. And it's important to put it into perspective because the rabbis tell us that all subsequent tragedies in Jewish history, they all originated on those 2 days. We don't look at even the Holocaust, even an Arab terrorist, you know, blowing up a building as something that stands alone. Those are all results and symptoms of being in Gullus, being in exile. And that all stem from the original exile which happened on Tisha B'Av. So everything which happened since then, we all relate back to that day. So every subsequent tragedy has to be viewed within the perspective of Tisha B'Av itself. Which is why traditionally we don't make other days of mourning in the Jewish calendar. We say in the keynote of Tisha B'Av, we mention that this is the day we're supposed to mourn everything. Because everything relates back to that day. I think it's very important to recognize not only the tragedy and the destruction, but we have to always understand the destruction which we experienced during these 3 weeks is all part of God's special providence of the Jewish people. Many commentaries point out how other nations did not experience the success we experienced or the destruction we experienced. It goes hand in hand. And I saw an interesting analogy. You know, parents, when they're trying to raise children, so you sometimes you reward and you give incentives, sometimes you have to punish. Now, even a stranger, if they want to give your child a reward, you're happy with that. If someone gives your child a candy, you say, thank you very much. They go to the guy in shul, pass to get the lollipops, okay, thank you. If someone else wants to discipline your child, give your child a little spank, or you yell at your child, you get upset. How dare you? The parent reserves the right to discipline a child. But strangers, others, can't discipline the child.
It takes the village.
Right? Other holidays, we're recognizing God's kindness towards us. And really, you know, that's something which is unique and special, miraculous. But that doesn't show the unique parent-child relationship. But when we focus on God punishing and disciplining us, like we focus on these 3 weeks, so that's something which reserves between a parent and child. That's a very special, intimate relationship in order to punish somebody. And therefore, we have to view this time of year not only as a time of tragedy and destruction, but it's all in God exercising His special care and intimate relationship with the Jewish people. That's what it is. Now we, as we live nowadays, we don't relate to life with the temple. I mean, everything lives back to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. And we live in a world for the past 2,000 years with no Beis HaMikdash. Our life as Jews, our daily Jewish activities, our Jewish life, we've adapted. And we don't know what it's like to live with the Beis HaMikdash. We don't realize how different life would be if it was still in existence. We've never offered a sacrifice. We've never made the pilgrimage on the three pilgrimage festivals at Shosh Regolim. We've never had to bring our first fruits to a Kohen in the temple. A lot of things we've never done. We've never seen the Kohen Gadol Yom Kippur, you know, wearing his special clothing, and you know, we've never seen all these miracles which occur there daily. Yeah.
I have a question which you don't have to answer now, but I'm going to forget.
Okay.
When you make Havdalah on Sunday night, is it regular Havdalah?
After Tisha B'Av, you mean?
Yeah. On Sunday night.
No, you don't do the fire. You don't do the spice. You'll just do the juice, the wine grape juice. Yeah, that's it. And the bracha of Havdalah. Yeah.
Thank you.
but it's a world which we had, which was kind of the center point of all Jewish life, and it's gone. And we don't relate to it even. We don't know what it's like to be Jews at the times of the temple. I always think that if you took a Jew who lived during temple times and put him in modern times, or vice versa, we would say, this is Judaism, we wouldn't relate. You know, this is how you observe the Torah. I mean, it's something that's just totally foreign to us in both ways. A temple times Jew coming here would say, this isn't Judaism. And we went back there, we said, this is Judaism. We're not used to it. It's something which is totally different. We've adapted to life without a temple. So something that we find very hard to relate to. So you have to always find that perspective. What can I relate to? Excuse me. What can I relate to? You know, I can't relate. I don't necessarily feel the lack of not being able to bring a sacrifice. I don't feel the lack of not having that place to go to on a holiday. I mean, we're used to having holidays as we have in our homes, in our shuls. So we have to always try to find that perspective which can help us have some meaning in the loss. And there was a lot that was lost. And we all could relate to the tragedies which occurred since then. We relate better to the Holocaust. We relate better to pogroms which killed out our ancestors in Russia or Ukraine or wherever it was. We relate more to expulsion from Spain. Modern tragedies relate to because it's a human loss, which we all can appreciate. The destruction of the temple is something which is so far from us, but yet that is the primary focus during these days. Everything else I said is only a result of that, a symptom of being in exile. But the main thing to focus on is what the temple means to us. And the temple meant a lot. The temple meant, you know, daily sacrifices. There are many, many mitzvahs which only occur in temple times. It meant a place of unity, of gathering for the entire people. A center point for the entire Jewish people to come to and get together. It meant witnessing miracles. There were 10 miracles which occurred daily in the temple, which one could go witness miracles, you know, at their convenience. It happened every single day, these miracles. So there's a lot that was lost, but I'd like to focus on one important point, which I think also is something which we can all relate to nowadays, which came from the temple itself. And again, there's so many points that could be focused on. We're going to just take one today. But the temple stood for so much more than we even can discuss or understand, because it was an entire institution which was the center of all Jewish life for a large part of our early history. And it's been gone for so long. So I'm going to just try to bring up one point the temple actually stood for. Before we get to the temple, I want to bring it back to the creation of the world. God created the first human being, Adam, he placed him in the Garden of Eden. And we all know, what was the first thing God told Adam? He told him that you could eat from all the trees of the garden, and don't eat from that tree over there. Don't eat from the tree of knowledge. But the Torah mentions another tree there. The Torah says that there were two trees in the garden that is specified by name. There was the tree of life, it's Chaim, and there was the tree of knowledge, it's Hadas Tov V'Ra. When the Torah describes the Eitz Chaim, the tree of life, the Torah says it was the Socha Gan, in the midst of the garden. And that says there was also a tree of knowledge. But the Torah stresses that the Eitz Chaim, the tree of life, was in the midst of the garden. And Rashi explains to us that means in the middle of the garden. The center point of the garden was the tree of life. The tree of knowledge, it's debatable if it was in the center or if it was somewhere else in the garden. The tree of life certainly was in the middle of the garden, right smack in the middle. So why is that significant? Why does the Torah have to bother telling us the geographical location of the tree of life? Why does that matter? So the tree of life, what else do we refer to as the tree of life? The Torah, right? We sing it in shul, it's chayim, the Torah is the tree of life. And the tree of life is an analogy. It's to the Torah itself. The Torah is called the tree of life. And the tree of life was supposed to represent to Adam and Eve the Torah. That's represented to them. There was a tree of life in the middle of the garden, and that was itself a symbol of the Torah. Now the Torah, as we're discussing it, didn't mean the stories we have in the Torah. I mean, the Torah was given to Moshe at Mount Sinai, you know, many, many years later. But all those ideals, all those goals God had for the world, the purpose of life, how to approach God, how to connect to God, was all symbolized by this Eitz Chaim, the tree of life. Because life really is connecting with the source of eternal life, which is God. The connection to God is plugging into eternal life. That's what God is. So the tree of life, which we know if he ate from the tree of life, he would have lived eternally. As the Torah says, he would live forever. That was the way to plug into God, to plug into spirituality, to plug into what the Torah stands for. Now why was it in the middle of the garden? Because even Adam, in the Garden of Eden, even Adam and Eve, they needed that focal point, right in the middle of everything, to show them this is what your activity should focus on. You have a lot of things to do in the garden. God says you should go, you should work the garden, you should protect the garden, whatever Adam had to do there, I'm not sure what he had to do. But having this symbol right smack in the middle of the garden was symbolic of the idea that all human functions should revolve around and focus on that point, that center point. You picture a circle, everything is focused on the center point, everything comes off the center point. That's how we view it. So human beings have many functions in life, and God told Adam and Eve, but your motivation and your focus and your ultimate goals should all be centered upon the tree of life, on the Torah, and on your relationship with God, and in your ability to plug into eternity. That's everything you should focus on. So that was the beginning of creation. And there was this symbolic point right in the middle of everything, the Eitz Chaim, the tree of life, showing you that all activities you do should focus on that one goal. The purpose of life is to connect with the tree of life, to connect with the Torah, to connect with God. What happened? So Adam and Eve sinned. They ate from the wrong tree. Right? They ate from the tree of knowledge. And the tree of knowledge, what does that represent? It represents a confusion. The commentaries explain that when you eat the tree of knowledge, you choose things which are pleasant, even though they may be detrimental to who you are. And you might avoid things that are good for you because they're unpleasant to you. I mean, there's a confusion in terms of goals and priorities. The tree of knowledge is called the Itadas Tovara, the tree of knowledge of good and evil. This means there's a mixture. Things get mixed up. You get confused. What's good? What's evil? What's sweet? What's sour? What's positive? What's negative? At that point, confusion entered the world. The tree of life presents clarity. That I know my purpose. I know what I'm supposed to be doing, what I'm not supposed to be doing. The tree of knowledge represents confusion. Things get muddled. Things get unclear and blurred. I don't know what's right. I don't know what's wrong. I'm going to do things that feel good, despite the fact they're bad for me. And we do that. You know, we do it physically and spiritually. We know we'll eat unhealthy foods and we'll overeat. We know it's bad for us. That's physically. And we'll cut corners or we'll cheat, even though it's bad for us spiritually. And we do it because it's easy, it feels good, and that's all a result of the tree of knowledge, that we have confusion in life. We don't know what's right and wrong, we can't make the right choices, we don't know how to choose good from evil. So God at that point throws Adam and Eve out of the Garden of Eden, and he's thrown into a world which is confusing, which we don't know what's right and what's wrong. But there was always that center point there of the tree of life, which should have given them clarity. So that was phase one of history. Now we get to try again. A couple thousand years later, the Jews stand at Mount Sinai. And again, at Mount Sinai, we receive the Torah, which is the tree of life. It's Chayani, the tree of life. And when the Jews heard God speak at Mount Sinai, they received the tablets, they received the Torah. So at this point, again, they achieved the level of clarity in life. They understood the priorities in life, they understood what's right, what's wrong, what's good, what's evil, what are the right choices to make. The rabbis tell us that when they studied on Sinai and received the first set of tablets, they should receive them, but as they received the Torah, the first at Mount Sinai, they will no longer forget the Torah ever. No forgetfulness. If you studied the Torah, it went in your brain, never left your brain. You always knew exactly what you learned. There's no more death at that point. Temporarily, they were removed from death, like in the Garden of Eden. They could have lived forever. Everything was clear. Everything was. They understood what was truth, what was false, what was good, what was evil. Everything was 100% clear. No more confusion. And that actually was considered a rectification of the sin of Adam and Eve, eating from the tree of knowledge. Because at this point, we achieved that level of clarity again. We were no longer confused about life. We had clarity. But shortly after what happened, Moshe came down with the second tablet, with the first tablets, and they're worshiping the golden calf. And the tablets were smashed. And that's the level they had reached. That level of clarity was destroyed. Again, they were thrown into a world of confusion. Once the tablets were broken, so rabbis tell us again, forgetfulness came in the world, and death came into the world, the confusion came into the world, everything went back to the same bleak situation which was there after the sin of Adam and Eve. So God gave us a second chance, right? We first had Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. They had the Eitz Chaim, the tree of life, in the middle to give them clarity. They chose to do something which gave them confusion. They're thrown into the out of the garden into the wilderness. Happened to us again in Mount Sinai. We were given the Torah. We had the Eitz Chaim. We had the Tree of Life. We had the clarity. We had we had purpose in life very, very clear. We then made the wrong choice. We worshipped the golden calf. Moshe had to break the tablets. And again, we were back into a world of confusion. Where good and evil weren't so clear. The lines are of a blurry. We don't know what's right and what's wrong. We don't know what's good and what's bad. And we were stuck once again in a world of confusion. Yeah.
Was Moses acting out of his own distrust, disfavor, or was he actually acting on an impulse from God?
That's a good question. The Talmud tells us that Moshe made his own decision to break the tablets, but God agreed to him after the fact. So God said he did the right thing. But it's Moshe's own decision. He didn't ask God, shall I break these tablets or not? God didn't tell him to. But Moshe, using his own logic, deduced it was the right thing to do. And then afterwards, God said, Yashar Koyach, you did the right thing. They told him. So then we were given another chance, though. Chance number three. Because God told the Jews, I want you to build the Mishkan. The Mishkan, there's different commentaries explain the purpose of the Mishkan. Some say the Mishkan was meant to be an atonement for the sin of the golden calf. That the Jews were supposed to have God's presence and God's clarity throughout the entire camp. Because they sinned, they couldn't have it everywhere, but they can confine it to one special place called the Mishkan, and there was a place we can go to access God. Some commentaries learn, Nachmanides explains, that the Mishkan was meant to be an ongoing Mount Sinai, basically. Mount Sinai was a place where God was clear, God spoke, it was miraculous. At Mount Sinai, you were inspired, and you were connected. The Mishkan was meant to be an ongoing, mini Mount Sinai, where it kind of to maintain the experience for all history. That's what it was meant. That intimacy between the Jews and God that was there at Mount Sinai was supposed to be confined to the Mishkan, according to Nachmanides. So some understood it to be a result of sin, and some understood it to be something which is meant to promote and to maintain the experience at Mount Sinai. But really, they can both be true. They can work hand in hand, both explanations. Because Mount Sinai was a place, again, of clarity and understanding of God. At Mount Sinai, we knew what was right and what was wrong. We knew what we should do in life, what was our purpose, and what we should do. And God, yes, should have been accessible from all over the place, and we shouldn't have had to confine God's presence to the Mishkan. But yet, when we confined God to the Mishkan, and we had that ongoing Mount Sinai experience, it gave us a place to go where we could actually experience that clarity of Mount Sinai. So back in your tent in the desert, maybe you wouldn't have that clarity. You weren't in the presence of God as you were at the Mishkan. But you had that center point where everybody could go to and feel the clarity once again. So it's the same theme. You have a center point, just like the Tree of Life, or just like Mount Sinai. You have clarity, which is able, you're able to achieve that center point, where you know, again, what are the choices to make in life? What's your goals in life? What's your purpose of living? And then you have, in the Mishkan as well, that same exact experience. The Mishkan was a place to go. And it was supposed to take the experience of Mount Sinai, put it into a box, and you can go to that box and always experience that same level of clarity and intimacy and revelation and inspiration you would at Mount Sinai. Now, comment, the Torah speaks at length about how the Jews camp in the desert. You know, the book of in Parsha Bamidbar and Parsha Snoso, even about Lusvasam, we talked about the Jews, how they camped and how they traveled. It was a very significant thing in the Torah. Now we read those parshas and we get bored sometimes. Why do I care who is in the west, who is in the east, and who is a neighbor to who? Why does it matter to me? But the commentaries point out a very important lesson you have from the Jews in the desert. The Jews in the desert, so the Mishkan was right in the middle. Surrounding the Mishkan was the Levites and the Kohanim, and then surrounding that was the rest of the Jews. Each tribe had their own special spot. Everyone knew where to go. So what's the significance of this? And it was all done based on God's word. Nobody just, I'll go to the north, I'll go to the south. It didn't happen. But God said where you should go. God said, okay, you're in the north, you're in the south, you're in the southeast. And they knew exactly where to go. It was very significant. So commentaries explain that this setup was a very, very important thing. Why is that? Because the center point of it all, again, was the Mishkan. Inside the Mishkan was the Holy of Holies, and there was the Holy Ark, and there were the tablets and the Sefer Torah, the Torah scroll. And the midpoint of the entire Jewish people, and all the camps in the desert, were the Torah. It's the same as that midpoint, that Eitz Chaim, the same thing we talked about from before, the Tree of Life, same thing you had in the middle of the Garden of Eden, same way you have it here as well in the Mishkan. Right in the middle of the Mishkan, you have the Holy Ark, inside the Ark, you have the tablets, and you have the Torah. So, what was the point of that? What's the message? It's the same exact message, that just like we said that Adam had to know that the goal of his life and the purpose of life is the Eitz Chaim, the Tree of Life, is the Torah, so too when the Jews were camped in the desert, they had to understand that the goal of all their activities needs to be the Torah, needs to be their way to connect with God. That's the goal of all their activities. So it was a physical center point, and it was supposed to be intellectually and emotionally a goal. It shows the people that this is our goal in life. No matter what we're doing, you know, we're over here on the outskirts of the camp. What we're doing, we're always focused back to the center point once again. That was the idea. So it promoted everyone to have clarity in life. And this is the this is explained by one of the early commentaries, the Akedah. The Akedah explains that, I'll just quote for you what he writes. He says that everybody should understand that the Torah is the ikkar, the primary goal of life. It's the center point around which all revolves. And that was the goal of having. That was the point of having it in the middle. That's what he writes. So when the Jews were camping in the desert, every single tribe had their place to go, but they all understood that no matter what I do, as long as I do it with the goals of God in mind, then I got my focus right. I got my purpose in life, you know, straight. I got my priorities straight. That was the point of the setup. And in a more specific way, it symbolizes us a major foundation of Jewish belief, which is that. We believe every human being is unique. Nobody's the same. I mean, God creates all unique and individual, unique people. Everyone has diverse talents. And the tribe is like that as well. There's 12 tribes because each tribe had their own makeup. They all had different talents, different jobs. Even the Torah describes it. You know, some of the tribes were businessmen. Some were farmers. And some were better as soldiers. And some were Torah scholars. Every single tribe had their own special, unique talents. Everyone was diverse. And you look around, and you look around different tribes, and you say, well, every single tribe is there to serve God, but they're also different. And the answer is yes, of course they're different. But as long as their goals are that we're here doing our job, using our talents to serve God, then everyone's doing the right thing. The center point was always God, was the Mishkan, was the tablets, was the Torah. And even though this tribe may have been out sailing, and this tribe is doing business, and this tribe is learning Torah, and this tribe is farming, everyone's doing their job, which they were suited for by God's by being God's creations, and that's what God wants out of us. We should figure out what are our talents and use them in order to promote God in the world. It has, and everyone's doing different things. When they go to the land of Israel, what happens? So a country needs to function. I mean, a country needs to have, you need to have garbage collectors too. You need to have plumbers, you need to have accountants, you need to have chefs, there's a lot of jobs to fill. So the Jews all move into the land of Israel and they have a lot to do. And we're trying to teach the Jews, you have to know, everyone's going to be doing something different. Everyone has a unique talent. Everyone's going to have a unique job. But make sure that you're always focused on the goal. The goal is we're all here to serve God and to connect to God in the deepest way possible. We're creating a country. We're creating a nation which is going to bring out the glory of God in the world. So how do you recognize each of these people as a servant of God, as part of the chosen people? The answer is, as long as their focus is, I am here to promote God's Torah with my talents, then that's something which that means that they got everything straight. They have the purpose clear. I guess a good analogy would be look at the military. So the military, I assume, has one goal. It's to protect the interests of the country. You know, it's to protect the people and the interests of the country. But you look at the military has tens of thousands of people who are enlisted, and some are doing the fighting, and some are washing the floors, and some are cooking the potatoes, and some are doing accounting in an office. But they're all part of the military. Because everyone's goal is, we're going to protect the interests of our country. That's their goal. But we have to have lots of diverse talents and workers to do that. It has to be done that way, or else you can't have a military if nobody's cooking the food. You can't have a military if nobody is dealing with the accounting. You can't have a military that, obviously you need the soldiers, but you need to have everybody doing their job to make it function. So how do we keep that purpose in mind? Again, you have to have that focal point for every single person. The accountant in his office working for the army, he has to be somebody also who believes and lives for the goals of the army and dedicates himself to it. And so is the chef, and so is the soldier fighting for it. Everybody has to have those goals in mind. So that's how we view ourselves. We are God's army, and we're all here to promote His purposes in this world. And as long as we have that focus very, very clear in our minds at all times, we're doing the right thing. So that's the Mishkan in the desert, and that's the temple. The temple in Israel was also, geographically, it wasn't exactly the center. It wasn't too far off, not exactly the center. But certainly, intellectually and emotionally, it was the center. It was the place upon which all Jews converged at certain points during the year. It was the point upon which we were all focused. The Gemara explains very beautifully, and we do it nowadays. We all focus our prayers towards Jerusalem. So if somebody, you know, we always think about we pray towards the east, but Jews in South Africa pray north, right? If a Jew in Syria would pray south, he'd pray south. And a Jew in China should pray west. You always pray towards Jerusalem. Because everything is focused on that one center point, which is Jerusalem. If in Jerusalem, you pray towards the center mount, the Temple Mount. And if you're on the Temple Mount, you pray towards the building of the temple. And if you're in the building, you pray towards the Holy of Holies. But everybody is converging on that one focal point, which is the Ark. And the Ark containing the tablets, which is the Torah God gave us in Mount Sinai. So that's the center point of all. And it reminds us of our purpose in life. That everything we do, you can be off in China doing whatever you do over there in China, but as long as your focal point is that I'm only here to promote God's will in this world and to bring out God's glory, then you're doing the right thing. You've achieved clarity and purpose in your life. We spoke about a few months ago the idea of Meisr Behema, of tithing our animals. And we tithe the animals. We said you take the animal as an offering you bring to Jerusalem. And we quoted there the Sefer Echinuch, who describes that every single family will have somebody who's been to Jerusalem who can come back and teach everyone else that which they've gained there. The inspiration, the knowledge, the wisdom. Jerusalem itself served as a place where everyone gathered. You saw miracles and you experienced God. You met righteous people. You met scholars. The Sanhedrin, the high court was there. And you could not leave Jerusalem uninspired. It was impossible. People went there, they were inspired and educated. It became the focal point of Jewish life, and it really serves that same exact purpose as we mentioned earlier, that the tree of life in the middle of the Garden of Eden is represented by the temple in the middle of Israel. That's how we view it. So the point I'm trying to bring out is that one thing that we've lost, again, we've lost so much not having a temple, but one major loss that we have is a loss of clarity in life. This place, Jerusalem with the temple itself, this location was a place where we can achieve clarity in who we are, why we're alive, what are our purposes in life, what are we supposed to do with ourselves, what are our goals. It'll help us make the right choices, have the right priorities in mind. But we lost this focal point. No longer are we so conscious all the time of our purpose in life. We tend to develop other goals. A lot of people live their lives for money, for power, for personal pleasure, and they ignore any sort of responsibility they have as Jews, as being the part of the chosen people. We don't have a place that we can go and recalibrate our goals in life. Everybody eventually, you know, ends up trying to do something which may be a little bit veering away from God's purpose and why He created us. But we can always recalibrate. The GPS always puts you back on the right route eventually. You know, we can all do that. But if you don't have the GPS, you don't get back on the right route. The temple is supposed to be that place that recalibrates ourselves. Whenever we go there, we would know, okay, I got to focus on this building. I got to go there, I have to experience it. And when you focus on that building, you experience the miracles and the inspiration of the temple, It gives you clarity in your purpose in life. That's what they give us. And that's gone. We're back. We're still in a stage where good and evil are not so clear. The lines are often very, very blurry. And we don't know what's right to do, what's wrong to do, what's good and what's evil. And we live a life where that's very, very, very confusing. Instead of keeping our eye on the goal and knowing what we're supposed to do and building up and becoming greater people, so the entire Jewish nation lives a life of survival. We try to survive, physically and spiritually. We're not building, we're not focusing, we're not heading towards our goal, but yet we're just trying to maintain ourselves because we don't know where to go. We don't know what to do sometimes. And we're living in a world of confusion. You know, the times when there was a temple, during those times, you know, it was not easy at times. We had our share of challenges. But at least people knew ultimately what their purpose was. It seems to be pretty clear that despite the fact that a lot of challenges during those times, people did not lose sight of the fact that we're God's people and we have something to achieve. So the next 3 weeks, you know, beginning this Sunday and moving on till Tisha B'Av, it's time to focus on what's missing. And one point that we can focus on is focus on this concept that one of the biggest losses we have is that life is so confusing sometimes. And we don't have a way to really clarify what we're supposed to do. Physically and intellectually and spiritually and emotionally and all levels, that things get very confusing at times. People nowadays, we question God, we question the Torah, we question divine providence. We have a lot of questions. And we pursue those things which we see as pleasant and enjoyable, but may not be beneficial to ourselves. That's how life is. Many Jews live life with many other goals in mind other than serving God. And that's because people are confused. They don't understand what their purpose is supposed to be. Our goal is to understand what we are lacking. We have to know that we can't make peace with life as is. One of the problems is in modern Jewish life is that we made peace with it. You know, we think this is life. This is what it means to be Jews. And we don't realize how much is missing. This time of year is supposed to whack us in the head and show us, no, you're missing something. Life is not, don't make peace with life as is. There's so much more that one can do. There's so much further we can go. And there's so much more we can accomplish. And we don't realize that. We don't know what it means. We don't know how far we could accomplish, how far we could go. But this time of year is supposed to make us think about that. And understand that we are living life in confusion, we're living life in darkness, we're living life in a way which was not God's intent for this world. It's based on our actions and our sins. We've been thrown out of our land, the same way that Adam and Eve were thrown out of the Garden of Eden, based on their sins. It's again the same exact model. And now we're in a world of confusion, where things are very blurry and dark. But when our goal in life is clear, if we can understand our priorities, so then everything really falls into place. The same commentary I quoted before, the Akedas Yitzchak, he writes that if we can achieve this clarity of understanding, so that will ignite our hearts with a strong desire to serve God, he writes, and then everything becomes sweet and pleasant and overtake our negative desires, and bring us to great heights. That's what will happen. But it's all a result of the fact that we don't know what we're supposed to do, that we're unclear. So again, there's so much we could think about in the next 3 weeks. There's so much we should think about a lot more. But it's one point we could think about is that do we have a way in life to achieve clarity of how we're supposed to live? What are we supposed to do? What's right? What's wrong? What's good? What's evil? What's pleasant? What's unpleasant? There's so many things we don't know what to do at times. And we got our purposes totally confused and corrupted many, many times in life. The temple was a way that we become a focal point. We can have a place to focus our activities on. We can have a place to go and achieve clarity. We can have people to go to and speak with, and they'll help guide us. And that's all gone. We don't have the temple. We don't have the place to go to. We don't have prophecy. We don't have the inspiration and miracles to witness. When you witness a miracle, so that also helps you to understand, you know, there's a God in the world, and you gotta live your life in that way. But we don't see the miracles all the time. So this is one of the major losses of the temple in life. Now we have to always recognize that everything else which stems from this is also a result of the same exact issue. Why is it that there have been so many tragedies since then? It's because Jews don't live their lives appropriately. God tells us if we would just live our lives right, then everything would clear up. We can go back.
All of us together, though.
Yeah, as a nation, yeah. No, it starts with the individual, obviously, but it's the nation. Yeah. If we as a nation, we get our act together and get our priorities straight, so then God will take away all these challenges, and we'll be able to go back to Israel and live peacefully and happily. It's only because we don't make the right choices all the time, as a nation and as individuals, And we have so much lack of clarity in life. So we're stuck here in exile dealing with all the challenges that we have. So this is the time of year we're supposed to think about the loss. And the Gemara tells us that all those who mourn over the loss of Jerusalem, they will merit to see its rebuilding. So if we can bring ourselves to sincere recognition of the loss that we've incurred, so that will help us also merit to see the joy of the rebuilding of Jerusalem and the final redemption. Any questions?
Thank you. This is very interesting. On Shabbos, at a share on Shabbos, the discussion was that the month of Nisan is when good things happen, the freedom. So I asked, does that mean that the Messiah is coming during the month of Nisan? They just all stare at me, where did that come from? But would that make sense? Doesn't that make sense?
There is a source for that.
Okay.
You're not far off.
All right.
I mean, there happens to be a lot of conflicting sources as to when the Messiah might come, but there is a source that says he'll come to month of Nisan. That's a month of redemption. It's a month of miracles. It's a month. It's a joyous month of the Jewish calendar. I mean, the word Nisan has the root from their nace, miracles, the miraculous month. It was the month where we redeemed the first time around, and where we might be redeemed once again. Again, there are other sources as well that he can come other times. We say, come every day. I wait for the Messiah every single day, is what we say. But there definitely is a source of such a thing. And we do view there are certain months we look at as more auspicious months, and months we look at as less auspicious months. You know, Av is a time you're not supposed to, during Av, you're not supposed to go to court with a non-Jew. It's considered an inauspicious time. Not a good idea.
During the month of Av.
Don't
go to court with a non-Jew.
Yeah. Same non-Jew. If you have a court case with a non-Jew, you're suing that. Either way, he's suing you, you're suing him. It's not a good time to go to court with a non-Jew, etc. But the point being that Av is a time which is not an auspicious month, and we don't expect great things to happen in Av necessarily. But Adar and Nisan are viewed as more auspicious months. And those are times where it says you should go to court with a non-Jew during. It says from Adar, it says in the month of Adar, the month of Purim, that's the best time for a court case. That's when you'll find the best, I'd say best luck, but God is mostly with you during the month of Adar. So you do have that in the calendar. So that's definitely a way to look at it. Again, and there are sources that Av is not a month for redemption, that the month of the tragedy will become a month of redemption. There's sources of that as well. Each one has its own explanation to it. But you're not off by saying that Nisan's a month of redemption. Yeah, not at all.
After the practices. Can I ask, unless anybody else has a question, another question? I understand on Yom Kippur it's called the Yom Tov, but since these two fasts coming up, we're not supposed to say Yom Tov. But can another perspective be part of what I heard today is if we do an introspection, how to be a better person, maybe as a nation we could come together and in fact be a better person, maybe a better nation and serve God better. So is it 100% wrong to wish somebody a good Yom Tov during these fasts? Is that 100% wrong? It's not preferred, but...
Well, what I'll tell you is that currently we live in a world where it's a day of tragedy and fasting. Okay. You're not supposed to greet anybody on Tisha B'Av. You're not supposed to say hello on Tisha B'Av. You're supposed to just stay to yourself on Tisha B'Av. That's the halacha. Not even supposed to greet somebody on Tisha B'Av. Even a shalom is a problem on Tisha B'Av. But on the other hand, the rabbis do point out that Tisha B'Av is referred to as a moed, as a holiday. And the idea of being referred to as a moed is kind of like we discussed before, that the tragedy and the catastrophe and the destruction are a result of God's great love for us. And it's a result of that great relationship. I understand the idea of a holiday. It's time where we kind of rendezvous with God. There's a connection with God made in a holiday. So typically it's a positive connection. We were saved from Egypt, Pesach, Shavuot, Sukkot. These are very joyous times. On Tisha B'Av also, it's a day in which we also experience miracles and divine providence, but yet we suffered from it. But it's only because God cares for us and God sees us as a special nation, that's why he did those things. The Kuzari, an early Jewish philosopher, he points out that non-Jews, they never experience the same level of divinity in their temples, also didn't experience the destruction either. It goes both ways. Because we are on such a high level and we have such a close relationship with God, that's why we have so much joy and so much spirituality. It's also why we experience so much destruction. So it is, in a certain sense, a holiday, You're not meant to go spread and telling other people good yontif on Tisha B'Av, but deep down we should understand it's a day where also it's because of our relationship with God, that's why we have such a day. So it's a day where you should feel close with God, even though you feel that God has, you know, we've suffered so much because of it. It's like we said before, it's like the parent disciplining the child. Only a parent does that. If a stranger smacks your child, you take him to court. you call the cops. The parent gives a spank to the child, you say that's discipline. That's the difference. And nowadays, we don't spank for kids either. But you understand the analogy. That's the idea. So it's a day where God gave us a spank, but only because God's our Father. And if He wasn't our Father, He wouldn't give us a spank. So there is a holiday aspect to it. That's what I would say.
Thank you.
But on Tisha B'Av itself, you're not supposed to greet people. You should just kind of, if someone greets you, you can respond kind of in a low tone, like you remember. But you should make it a big greeting. But that's what we say.
Okay.
Are you able to say Yasher Koach after performance at the Bema?
It's a good question. I would say Tisha B'Av, just say to yourself. That's what I would say.